Welcome to our Gold to podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're delving into history writing. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I'm thrilled today to welcome Rachel Trethewey. I've said that wrong again, haven't I?
You're doing fine.
The Cornish name is flummoxing me. Welcome to Goldster. It's brilliant to have you here, Rachel. And Rachel is going to be talking, amongst other things, about this gorgeous new book, Mothers of the Mind, which is really fascinating. So welcome and tell us about this wonderful book. Who are the Mothers of the Mind?
Well, they are the mothers of Virginia Woolf, Agatha Christie and Sylvia Plath. And each of them is fascinating in her own right, not just because she was the mother of these famous daughters. And unfortunately, they've been forgotten by history. And I thought we should introduce you to them.
I think that's wonderful. Like you, I try to write about women who've been unfairly forgotten in history. So this appealed to me so much. And tell me where the idea came for putting all three of them in a book. Had you had ideas for writing about them individually, or did you just think this would be a great link between mothers and daughters?
Well, it really happened when in 2018, I went to an exhibition at the Tate of St. Ives, and I came across this mesmerizing photograph of Julia Stephen next to a quote by her daughter, Virginia Woolf, saying, "We think back through our mothers if we're women." And this quotation just really resonated with me because I'm really close to my mother. And it started me thinking about her relationship with her mother. And I looked into that and it was an absolutely fascinating story. But I widened it out and thought, well, I wonder if there are other female authors who've been profoundly influenced by their mothers. And I'm a great reader of literary biographies. And I suppose Sylvia Plath and Agatha Christie had always been on my radar too about their complicated relationships with their mothers. So I thought, well, maybe we can do it as the three of them. And we can sort of interrelate it as well as tell the separate stories and get an overall view of what motherhood can mean in its many shapes and forms.
It's a really great book. I've so enjoyed it. I thought I knew quite a lot, particularly about Julia Stephen, but I've learned so much from this book. So tell us individually about each one. Would you start with Julia Stephen and explain who she was and what happened in her life? Because it's quite tragic.
Oh, it is. I mean, Julia Stephen, the one thing everyone always agreed about her was that she was exceptionally beautiful, and she had this rather austere, very pure beauty, like a marble Greek statue. And then when she was in her teenage years, she became a pre-Raphaelite muse and was painted by G.F. Watts, Edward Burne Jones and William Holman Hunt. And not only did they paint her, they also fell in love with her because she was so lovely. But the person who really captured her was her aunt, the pioneering photographer, Julia Margaret Cameron. And it was her photograph which first made me really interested in Julia because it's so arresting and so modern. And Julia was really looking for a wonderful hero to awaken her from her romantic dream. And she fell in love with this very handsome young lawyer called Herbert Duckworth. And they married in 1867 and had three blissful years together. During that time, they had two children. And then when Julia was pregnant with their third child, they went to stay with her sister. And Herbert was picking a fig from a tree for Julia. And as he reached up, he had a rupture of an abscess inside him, and he was dead within 24 hours. And Julia was absolutely devastated. She was in her early 20s and left a single mother with three young children. And the photos of her at this time just show this sort of spectral figure who looks like she doesn't want to live anymore. However, the only thing that really helped her was doing things for other people, and she found that nursing was her vocation. So she rushed around nursing everyone in her family and friends, and also did lots of philanthropy. She thought she'd never find love again, but she did with the biographer and intellectual Leslie Stephen. He'd lost his wife, and I think they were really brought together by grief.
Yeah.
You know, sort of what began as friendship turned into love. They got married and had four children together, including Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell.
And I love that out of all that family, the most famous are two of the daughters.
Exactly.
We have eight children with stepchildren all. I just think that's wonderful.
It is, you know, because Julia, surprisingly, was certainly no feminist, and she always sort of pandered to the superiority of men. And much to Virginia and Vanessa's annoyance, it was the boys, not the girls, who got the better education and were sent off to school. But guess who triumphed? The girls, who are the ones we now remember.
Yeah, and I find it really fascinating because Julia is so iconic when you're in the pre-Raphaelite world, as I am, and much of my writing career. Julia is such an iconic figure. And she is, as you say, known especially for her beauty. But the discovery of her kind of nursing vocation and things was really fascinating to me. Mm. And the fact that everybody seemed to just look to her to help them with everything. I also hadn't realized how long it took Leslie to persuade her to marry him. And that was quite interesting to me because I had just thought, you know, or perhaps she was, you know, longing to find a father for her children, a second husband, because I knew she really adored Herbert Duckworth. But it really took a long time and a lot of angst, didn't it, with her mother advising her. And again, the relationship between Julia and her mother is interesting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, they were so close. I mean, there's a photo of them and they look completely inseparable. And I mean, Leslie, I think, was quite jealous of Julia's relationship with her mother, Maria. And when her mother died, he said, "You have the most exceptional relationship of any two human beings, really, with your mother." And I think that sort of passed on, actually, not with Virginia and Vanessa, who she was quite distant from, but with her daughter, Stella, from her first marriage. And Stella was absolutely devoted to Julia and really could hardly cope when Julia died.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great deal of grief, which I know is the case whenever you're writing about the 19th century. There was so much young death. And but through that, do you think that's what made her such an iconic figure almost? Because she was living in an age when death became revered thanks to the death of Prince Albert. Do you think it was almost fashionable to be grieving in that way?
I think it was. I mean, when you read about these sort of things that seem like morbid sentimentality now, I mean, I found it quite amazing when I heard that in their Kensington townhouse, Julia kept Herbert's sort of barrister's wig and Leslie has a model of the hands of his wife, Minnie, you know, sort of made in alabaster or whatever. And I think there was this complete cult of death. Although perhaps we've gone too much the other way, that we just sort of pretend it doesn't happen. But as you say, I mean, it was so much part of everyday life, but the Stephen family had more than their fair share.
Mm. And just to connect Virginia Woolf to others, because of course you mentioned Minnie, Leslie's first wife, of course she was the daughter of William Thackeray. So Virginia Woolf was connected to Thackeray. But also tell us about all the incredible people that Julia Stephen herself was related to through marriage or blood.
Yes, I mean, she was descended from the famous Patel sisters, who were born in India to a sort of Anglo-Indian family. And they were all, these sisters were great beauties. And they sort of came over to Europe and made a real mark. They were different from everyone else. They were very self-confident. And her aunt Sarah married Toby Prinsep and set up Little Holland House, this salon, which had all the great writers, politics, and politicians and intellectuals of the day meeting there. And Virginia was fascinated by this and wrote about imagining her mother in this situation. She was a sort of peaceful centre of this whole incredible world.
It is a really, really interesting thing. So tell us how Virginia's relationship with her mother evolved and then what happened after her mother's death.
Well, Virginia actually never felt, while her mother was alive, that close to her in a way, because Julia was so preoccupied with rushing around helping everyone else that Virginia actually said she never had any time on her own with her mother. The only time she was with her was if Virginia was ill or when she was being taught lessons with Vanessa. And at those times, Julia could actually be quite impatient as a teacher. But very tragically, Virginia hoped she'd get closer to her mother as she got older. And her mother died when she was only 13. But for the rest of, really, Virginia's life, her mother haunted her. And she said that she was with her as an invisible presence, more than any real presences were. And she was always trying to recapture her in her writing. She would write about her in memoirs, in some of her characters. And really, she only exercised this ghost when she wrote To the Lighthouse in 1926. And even then, her mother would come back and, as I say, really haunt her, even to the end of her life. But, I mean, Julia did encourage her early writing, because Julia wrote as well. She wrote some fantastic short stories for children and also essays. So the writing talent came not only from Leslie Stephen, who published the Dictionary of National Biography, but also from Julia.
And after her mother's death, of course, things became much more difficult. Do you want to explain about with Virginia Woolf, with her half-siblings?
It was very, very difficult. Perhaps at least part of Virginia's mental health problems came from being sexually abused. While her mother was alive, she was abused by one of her stepbrothers. And then after her mother's death, she was abused, it seems, by another. And there was mental instability in the family, on Leslie's side of the family. But I think this sexual abuse really shattered Virginia at a formative age. And it meant that she found it very hard having sexual relationships with anyone. She married, and Leonard Woolf was a very supportive husband in many ways. But their sexual relationship was pretty non-existent, and her mental instability meant that it was thought to be unsafe for her to have children. And in a way, Virginia resented this. Then perhaps the great love of her life was Vita Sackville West. And even in that relationship, it's thought by the families, if they ever slept together, it was once.
And that really surprised me, because I'd always thought that they'd had this you know, very loving, very sexual relationship. So I was so interested to read that. I think, gosh, so that in itself was a passionate friendship, similarly to her marriage.
It was. And I think actually her very close relationships with women, of which there were many, were in a way looking for a mother figure. She said the thing she most admired was maternity in these women. She admired Vita, partly for her sort of grandeur and her background, but also that she was a mother. And I think because her mother had died when she was so young, she was always looking for this nurturing from someone else. And that was provided either by Leonard or her female relationships.
Yeah, and Vanessa, of course, mothered her a great deal, didn't she?
She did. I mean, there's this sort of extraordinary story about they were traveling, I think, across to France and in their 20s, and Virginia sat on Vanessa's lap. I mean, you know, it was just sort of a very odd image. But I think Vanessa was very maternal and had children of her own. And in a way, Virginia was jealous of this on a number of levels, both that her sister was a mother, but also in her sister mothering other people rather than her.
It's a very complex relationship, isn't it? Do you think that her parents, I think her sister was, wasn't she? But do you think her parents were aware that the sexual abuse had happened, or were they completely unconscious of it?
I suppose they were unconscious of it. I think in those days, nobody talked about these things. But you wonder what was going on behind the scenes in a lot of Victorian homes. I mean, I think the problem was as well that Julia was out of the home so much, she probably didn't know what was going on all the time. Yeah. And she, you know, wouldn't have thought her beloved sons, who she doted on more than her daughters, would have done something like that. But I think actually, if you look at Julia's aunt, Julia Margaret Cameron's photographs, they're rather disturbing, of all these children dressed in sort of nymph-like outfits or naked. I mean, to the modern eye, they are quite disturbing. So I think quite a few things were going on beneath the surface that were sort of hushed up and shoved under the carpet, so different from our own world.
Yes. The one thing I found really fascinating, and I looked up the series because I'd not seen it before, was the photograph of Virginia in 1926 in Vogue. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, that photo is really, really indicative of her relationship with her mother. I mean, we obviously know Virginia as this amazingly modernist writer who's changing the whole sort of face of literature. But when she was photographed for Vogue, she dressed up in an outfit of her mother's. She'd kept her mother's clothes for years, and it was almost as though she was trying to become her mother. But it looks really incongruous, that photograph. Because sort of great big puff sleeves, which are totally not the style of the era. Yeah. And, you know, there's a sort of almost mocking look on Virginia's face, and you wonder what signals she was giving off. But at this time, I think she was really trying to get under her mother's skin and almost blur the boundaries between them. She obviously wrote to the Lighthouse, and she was thinking a lot about her mother during the 1920s.
And it looks so incongruous because today, if one was to wear one's mother's clothes from the past, it would be seen as fashionable. But of course, in the 1920s, Victorian clothes, there wasn't this desire for vintage fashion then. And Virginia's so angular. She's so angular. And her mother's dress is so Victorian and curvaceous. It looks so strange, doesn't it? I thought that she would look quite statuesque in it, but actually it looked almost like a mockery. It was a very strange series of photographs. And the fact that she chose to be photographed that way in Vogue, to me, was really fascinating.
I think so many things were probably going on within that. I mean, Virginia did have issues about how to dress. It worried her. And she wrote about it in a short story called The Dress, about how you can feel really out of place at a cocktail party if you wear the wrong thing. And so it was something that troubled her, but I think she was making some sort of point, and it's this sort of ambivalence in her relationship with her mother that she sort of wanted to take some things from her and be like her in some ways, but she also rebelled against everything she stood for because her mother, surprisingly, was an anti-feminist. She didn't want women to have the vote. And of course, we all know that Virginia is a feminist icon who did more to campaign for women in intellectual terms than most people.
Before we move on to Agatha Christie's mother, do you want to just tell us about the angel in the house and what that meant for Julia and Virginia?
Yeah, the angel in the house is a very important theme in the book because actually Julia's mother, Maria, was very friendly with Coventry Patmore, who wrote this iconic Victorian poem called The Angel in the House, all about this sort of idealised model of Victorian femininity.
It's the most nauseating poem, if you haven't read it, by the way, everyone.
Really nauseating. Anyway, Julia was always treated as the angel in the house. Men put her on a pedestal and thought she was exceptionally beautiful, but also they turned her into this sort of plaster saint. And she sort of seemed to epitomise for them the angel in the house. But ironically enough, she was never in the home. Leslie was in the home much more. Julia was always out of it doing her own thing. She wasn't an angel in the house. But this theme continued. And when Virginia was writing about her feminism in 1931, she described how she needed to actually kill the angel in the house. And I think this had obviously a political message, but also a very private one about how she had to escape from all these sort of conventions of femininity that her mother and her mother's generation had put on her, that she was the antithesis of this whole Victorian model of femininity.
Yeah, a fascinating, what is it? Let's move on to a very, very different woman, Clara Miller. Tell us about her, and quite an interesting background long before Agatha Seton thought of.
Yes, I mean, Clara Miller is very, very different from Julia Stephen. Clara always thought she was plain, but actually Agatha said she was a brilliant woman and very, very interesting. And in some ways, I think Agatha thought that her mother was more interesting than she was herself. She said her mother had lots of very original ideas and her mind would flip from one thing to another, like a butterfly flitting from one flower to another. And also her mother had this sort of ability, this psychic sixth sense, which always fascinated Virginia, and this incredible sensitivity. But really, to understand Clara, I think we need to look at her insecure childhood. And when she was just 8 years old, her father died. And her mother didn't have much money and had two sons to bring up and wanted to send them to boarding school. So she allowed her wealthy older sister, Margaret, to adopt her daughter. And Margaret was childless and she was able to give Clara a much more luxurious lifestyle and a better education. But unfortunately, Clara was desperately homesick and missed her brothers and her mother. And it made her feel very insecure. And Agatha always believed that this gave her a sort of natural melancholy that she never got over and that she always felt rather insecure in her relationships. The only thing that made it better for her was when Aunt Margaret's stepson came along, Frederick Miller, and Clara fell madly in love with him because he showed her kindness and actually said she had lovely eyes. And she wrote him some very intense love poems, which might have been claustrophobic for some people, but it seemed to work for him. And they married.
They were invited, I guess. They obviously both just were craving love, weren't they?
They were, because Frederick's mother had died So his father was married to Aunt Margaret. And I think they both wanted that security, this sense of belonging that they just didn't have. And so they actually had a really happy marriage, which gave them both what they needed.
Yeah. Yes. And so tell us about the theme of adoption that comes across in Agatha's work as a result of her mother.
Yeah. She was very influenced by what happened to her mother. And she was always rather against the idea of people being adopted and saying, you know, even if you can be offered a better life, it's much better to be with your birth family. And she wrote about this in some of her novels, that usually people who adopt, it doesn't turn out very well. And the mothers are often sort of, the adopted mothers are trying to assert power over people. And I think that she was critical of her Aunt Margaret, that actually she didn't treat Clara as she would have her own daughter. Clara always had this great love of clothes and things, and adoptive mother in Aunt Margaret didn't give her the clothes that she had. You know, she was going off getting things from the Paris collection. Clara wasn't given them.
I found that so strange, because you'd think if you'd been so desperate for a child and that she was wanting to adopt her sister's daughter, it's really strange she didn't want that to be a kind of extension of herself and take her off clothes shopping and things. It seems a rather odd thing to have done, really.
Yeah. I mean, also, she didn't give her a season. And I think this affected Clara later on. She couldn't afford to give Agatha a London season, but she was determined her daughter would have every opportunity. And so she took her up to Egypt for the season. So you get the feeling that Agatha was, although she was very fond of her Aunt Margaret, or Auntie Granny, as she called her, and mm-hmm. I think she's quite a model for some of her strong female characters like Miss Marple, I think she's quite critical of her.
Yeah. Yes. So tell us about this relationship between Agatha and Clara themselves.
It was, I think, a really amazing relationship, about as good as it gets between a mother and daughter. Clara had Agatha when she was about 36. She was her last child. And unlike Julia, who was always out of the house, Clara totally dedicated herself to Agatha, and she loved being in her home. It wasn't a cage for her. It was where she felt she belonged, because she lacked it as a child. And so she'd literally get down on the floor and play with Agatha and just always be there for her. And Agatha always said she had a very, very happy childhood. And I certainly thought she did. And she said that while her mother was alive, she never felt alone, because there was someone there who just totally understood her. They didn't need to communicate. I mean, there's a story about when Agatha was a little girl and she went off for the day with her father and sister, and this guide pinned a live butterfly to her hat, and it completely ruined the day for her. And yes, they didn't understand why, but as soon as her mother saw her, she totally understood. And it was this intuitive understanding between them that always meant so much.
Mm, yeah. And how do you think that that affected Agatha as a woman, an incredible career woman, a woman who, you know, became essentially a fabulous businesswoman in her writing?
I think her mother gave her that confidence. She always believed in herself in one way, but Agatha was never a feminist. Unlike Virginia Woolf, her attitude, which was instilled in her by both her mother and her grandmother, was that you should try and marry well, and that you must keep your husband happy, and you must pay lip service to the idea that men are superior, even though actually in all the families I write about, the matriarchy were really in charge, but service was paid to the men being in charge. And I think that Agatha, because of the confidence her mother gave her, went out and was able to write and earn more money than her husband's. But she sort of carried it lightly. She always played it down a bit.
Yeah.
I think there's also a slight rebellion against Virginia Woolf, because obviously Virginia Woolf talked about having a room of your own to write. And Virginia and Agatha always said, well, I can do it anywhere. All I need is a typewriter and a desk.
Yes, well, as she proved when she was on archaeological digs and things with her husband. But I would say that she might not have called herself a feminist, but she lived in an extremely feminist way. And the way her characters, she often takes the mickey really out of quite wussy women, doesn't she? I mean, she often gets the women have the last laugh quite frequently in her books.
Definitely. I mean, as I say, she wasn't ideological, but her life was feminist. Because, I mean, she became, you know, the best-selling author after Shakespeare and the Bible, and you know, she didn't need to shout about it. I think she was against ideologies. She just got on and did it.
Yes. And I think, you know, perhaps just by, she was leading by example, wasn't she? You know, and becoming part of such an extraordinary world where, you know, the queens of crime, as they're known, that was the time when women writers were far more prized than male writers. So what an incredible time to be living through for them.
Yeah, and I think she also didn't want people to be judged by their sex. I mean, she said you get weak women and strong women, weak men, and, you know, there are quite a few weak men in her books. And actually, as I say, women often run circles around them, but they don't make a sort of dance about it.
And I mean, Poirot, I know she famously didn't like him, but the way she kind of writes about him with really poking fun at him and his all his vanities, it does make me laugh. I wonder how many of the men that she knew in life would get put into bits of Poirot.
I think so. I mean, I think she drew on people she knew a lot. And, you know, subtly described them or not so subtly. And I think also, I mean, there's a lot of Auntie Granny, certainly, and bits of Agatha and her mother, certainly Miss Marple, and very much their idea of right and wrong and being no nonsense and going under the radar. And I think there's a lovely quote about that, you know, the old ladies who sit and knit actually don't miss a trick and see everything that's going on.
So how did Agatha's older siblings feel about her relationship with her mother, or their mother, I should say?
I think Agatha was the closest, because when her father Fred died, Agatha was left alone with her mother. Agatha was only 11. And so the two were thrown together. And the social life had gone once Fred had gone. They had a great social life in Torquay. But once he died, there was less money. And also Clara just didn't want to entertain. So I think Madge, the elder sister, was close to her mother, but not as close as Agatha. And I think although the two sisters got on, there was a lot of competition between them, because actually Madge was a writer before Agatha was.
Yes.
She wrote stories for Vanity Fair and had them published. And then she had a play, I think it was called The Claimant, which appeared in the West End before Agatha had one. And Agatha wasn't too happy about that. the problematic child was more her brother, Monty. And Monty always clashed with Clara. And Agatha said maybe it was because they were too similar. But Monty was sort of this lost soul who'd never really settled to anything and had a rather sticky end and really worried his mother sick. So the daughters, again, were much easier to live with and much more successful, a bit like with the Stephen family, than the men.
Yes. Interesting, isn't it? So let's move on to Aurelia Plath. Again, this is the one I knew least of before your book, because like many teenagers, I was obsessed with Sylvia Plath as a teenage girl. So I knew a little bit about her, but I was fascinated by your discovery. So do you want to, probably people are less familiar with Aurelia Plath than anybody else in your book. Give us an overview of who she was and what her life was like before Sylvia came along.
Yeah, well, I think Aurelia is actually very like Sylvia in a lot of ways and very talented. Aurelia was born in America to immigrant families, an immigrant family. And because of this, because she had Germanic roots and growing up in World War I, she was very bullied at school. And this influenced not only her, but how Sylvia saw the world. And I think it gave her a sense of the outsider's position. And she wrote about her mother's experience in some of her short stories. But Aurelia was a really bright young woman, and she had a lot of talent, and her parents were very aspirational for her. Ideally, she'd have liked to have become a writer or academic herself. But because of financial necessity, she had to take the safer option and become a teacher. In this era, the easiest way to climb up the social ladder was still to marry the right man. And when she was just in her 20s, she fell in love with this urbane older man in his 40s, the pioneering soil engineer, Carl Tazaghi, who she worked for a bit. And they had this intense love affair. And I think looking at his diaries, she probably lost her virginity to him in the hope that he'd marry her. And then, I mean, for her, he was the one. But for him, she was just one of many. And so he finished their relationship and then shortly afterwards married another young woman, which was really totally devastating for Aurelia. And I think she really never loved another man like that. And for her, he was the equivalent of Ted Hughes for her daughter, the great love of her life, the man she considered to be a genius.
That's so interesting, isn't it? That correlation between the two.
I think, you know, they had this idea of, you know, he's got to be outstanding and amazing, the man I marry, you know, and there's a sort of thing of sort of wanting to have your own career, but also to be the sort of helpmate of this great genius male figure. And you can see that in both mother and daughter.
Yeah.
But on the rebound, Aurelia then married another older academic, Otto Plath, and their marriage wasn't happy at all. And so when their firstborn child, Sylvia, was born, they put everything into her, really hothoused her. But tragically for the family, Otto died from the complications of diabetes when Sylvia was only 8 years old. So Aurelia was left a single mother and had to go out to work and earn money. And she was determined that her children should have all the opportunities she'd lacked. But Sylvia slightly resented this because she believed her mother only loved her if she achieved academically. And she also felt that someone being that self-sacrificing placed a burden on the person they love.
Yes, it's such a complex thing, isn't it? Because you can feel that Aurelia was absolutely trying to be the best mother possible. And Sylvia blamed her for so many things, didn't she?
I know. I mean, reading it as a mother, you're just like, oh my goodness, you know, because Aurelia gave up so much. But perhaps she shouldn't have put her own life on hold. You know, she was widowed in her 30s. She never married again. It was just too much of a focus on Sylvia. But rather than play a game, blame game, I sort of feel it was just this clash of personalities. And actually, mother and daughter were so close, they couldn't tell where one ended and the other began. And they both sort of wanted the same things from life. And being that close could be claustrophobic. Both of them realized this. And it was, of course, so many problems in their relationship and end so very sadly.
So tell us what happened when Sylvia, because I actually think it's fascinating that all three of your subjects lost a parent very, very young. We maybe come back to that later, but tell us what happened next. What happened in Sylvia's life as she was growing up and starting to become recognised as quite brilliant?
Yeah, well, Sylvia was a genius, really. You know, she always came out top at class, and then she went to Smith College, and she was achieving in every front. You know, she was this radiant girl who was successful socially with lots of different men, and she was very successful academically. She was getting early work on Mamselle, this top magazine. But it all fell apart in 1953 when she came home and she just sort of felt empty in her core. And she made a suicide bid, which was totally devastating for her mother. And she had electroshock therapy. And Aurelia certainly believed she was never the same again. Mm. She also had a psychiatrist at that time who encouraged her to blame her mother. I mean, this was sort of the fashion at the time. And so this began to sow the seeds of the deterioration of her relationship with Aurelia. But somehow, Sylvia managed to pick herself up and came to England, came to Cambridge, where she got a Fulbright scholarship. And she met the incredibly handsome, talented poet Ted Hughes and felt she'd met the love of her life. And she married him. And I think Aurelia felt a sense of relief because the pressure was taken off her now and Ted Hughes was more in charge of Sylvia. And to begin with, Sylvia sort of put more into Ted's career, supporting him. But by the end of her life, she was writing incredible poetry herself, particularly the final poems, which were written after her marriage to Ted Hughes broke up.
Yes. Tell us how her mother coped when Sylvia did make the decision to move overseas. Do you think that Aurelia was relieved? Was she devastated? What did that do to their relationship?
Actually, they got on best when they were apart. And at this time, Sylvia always wrote letters home, which were eventually, after her death, published by her mother. And within these letters, they both were able to sort of fulfil the roles they wanted to be. And, you know, Aurelia was able to be the mother that Sylvia always wanted at a distance of the Atlantic between them. They clashed more when they were together. And so Aurelia got on with her own life, climbing up in academia and seemed to have a new lease of life. She travelled around Europe and showed herself to be, you know, a keen traveller. And Sylvia said both she and Ted were rather impressed by her. So there was this happier period between them. And the letters sort of suggest a pretty happy relationship.
Yeah. And then you've talked about Mrs. Ramsey Into the Lighthouse with Virginia Woolf. Tell us what Sylvia did with her writing and her kind of memories of her mother.
Yeah, all three writers used sort of fictionalized versions of their mothers and in their characters. And obviously, Mrs. Ramsey Into the Lighthouse captured Virginia's mother. But unfortunately for Aurelia, Sylvia's portrayal of her as Mrs. Greenwood in The Bell Jar was much more unsympathetic. And it was very much based on Sylvia's time in a psychiatric unit and was very critical of her. But the even sadder thing was that Aurelia only became aware of this after Sylvia's death to suicide. She didn't know what was in this book, The Bell Jar. And when she found it, I mean, it was a double blow, having lost her daughter to suicide. And then finding this portrayal of their relationship, which was so negative, was just absolutely terrible for any mother.
Absolutely devastating. And trying to deal with her daughter's suicide as well as that. How did you find you were able to research this? I mean, obviously, Letters Home is very much out there. But how did you go about trying to find out all the information about Aurelia and Sylvia?
Well, I was really lucky, actually, because, I mean, I was writing in the pandemic, so I couldn't go over to America to look at this. But the libraries, the Lilly Library and also the one at Smith were great and photocopied all the material for me. And what is so interesting is that they have all the notes Aurelia made alongside publishing Letters Home and all her comments for the draft introduction. And what I found was Aurelia was really trying to seize back the narrative and answer her daughter back. And she did this through that, but also through a series of letters to this great friend of hers, a younger man called Leonard Sannazzaro, who was a poet and academic. And through this, she answered every point that Sylvia made. So you've got this dialogue going on even after Sylvia's death between mother and daughter, and each one trying to seize the narrative. And as you read it, you think, actually, both of them had elements of truth. They knew each other so well that actually what they said about each other was looking from a negative perspective at each other, but had elements of truth. And it was absolutely fascinating because Sylvia wrote poems like The Disquieting Muse and Medusa, which were really critical of Aurelia. And Aurelia set it in the context of when her daughter wrote it and why, and said, well, this isn't accurate. I mean, she was really angry about what her daughter had written. She felt that it had been a violation, was the word she used. And there was anger as well as love and pride in her daughter after Sylvia's death.
That's so understandable, isn't it? What was her opinion of Ted Hughes, Aurelia's opinion?
Actually, they got on pretty well. When Aurelia first met him shortly before Sylvia married him, because it had all happened in London, well, Cambridge and London, she said she liked him. She found him very gentle, and I just think there was a big sense of relief that the pressure was off her for a bit, that once her daughter was married, before that, if anything went wrong, Aurelia had to step in. And I think they had a strange relationship, really, Ted Hughes and Aurelia, because they both knew the problems there could be with Sylvia and that she could be very difficult to live with, but that she had mental health problems. So sometimes they clashed, and Ted would moan that, you know, Aurelia had this very bourgeois view that he should, you know, sort of work as an academic rather than follow his poetic vocation. But there was a sort of grudging respect for each other. I mean, it became more difficult after Sylvia died because they sort of were battling over what could be published. Obviously, Aurelia published The Letters Home. Ted then published Sylvia's journals, which showed just how critical Sylvia was of her mother. And again, that was another sort of dagger in Aurelia's heart.
Yeah. Did Aurelia know he was going to do that? Did Ted talk to her about it before he did that? Do you know?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think they were in constant correspondence talking because Aurelia always wanted to keep in touch with Sylvia's two children. And so she'd come over to Britain most years and see them, and Ted would facilitate that. I know that they had correspondence over Letters Home, and there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between Ted and Aurelia. And there's quite a lot of debate about which one of them said, you know, which letters could be used and which couldn't, because both had a different narrative to put across. But they did manage to, you know, sort of work together. And I think it was, on the whole, quite a respectful relationship.
And now, you knew Ted Hughes personally, didn't you? Could you tell us about that?
Yes, well, I knew him because he was a great friend of my uncle's. They used to go fishing together. I mean, I only met Ted a few times. I mean, I was in my early 20s, and I suppose he was in his 50s. But I remember that he was just this sort of magnetic person. And he was the type of person, I mean, my mother was the same age as him. And we all just went, my goodness, he was just like nothing else. I would say he was probably the male equivalent of someone like Marilyn Monroe. He had this attraction to a woman of any age or whatever. He had these incredible eyes and this very mesmeric voice and just this incredible presence that was sort of like a shaman.
Yeah.
I didn't really get to know him terribly well because I was a journalist at the time on the Daily Express, and Ted hated journalists. And apparently my uncle said, well, he says, once a journalist, always a journalist. So I can't claim too close a relationship.
But it's amazing. You have that physical, you know, connection.
It was interesting.
Sylvia Plath. That's fascinating. Were you rereading a lot of works by Plath and Wolfe and Christie, or reading some for the first time? And what was that like?
Well, it was wonderful, actually. Some were wonderful than others. Some were quite depressing, but it was. And I mean, although I was born in Torquay, so the home of Agatha Christie, and so, you know, she had always been there in my life in a way. I had read a little bit in my teenage years, but I hadn't been a massive fan. And the more I read, the more I became a really big fan of hers. And I'm not a great crime reader, so I can see the cleverness of her plots, but I really enjoyed her Westmacott novels, which are the most revealing of her. They're not crime. They are very personal stories about sort of love and family relationships. So I absolutely loved those. And then with Virginia Woolf, I mean, that was another treat. I'd read things like Mrs. Dalloway when I was in my 20s, and I couldn't relate to them at all then. I thought, oh, this is a bit boring, nothing much happens. But then rereading them as a middle-aged woman, I absolutely loved it and just thought, my goodness, the subtleties, and she really understands people. And like you with Sylvia Plath, I mean, as a teenager, I mean, I read everything, you know. I sort of studied her at A-level. I can remember, you know, sort of lines, I think, from the one about the beekeeper going round and round my head before I did my A-level exams.
Yes.
But to come back to it all as an older woman is really interesting, and how you see it and what appeals to you. So it was nice to revisit some, but also discover new books as well. And I mean, I found it, I mean, it's quite disturbing, obviously, particularly the Ariel poems and also some of Virginia Woolf's writing. With Agatha Christie, it was more of a sort of safe haven where you come back to this underlying wisdom where everything turns out ultimately all right in the world.
Yes. Isn't that nice? We all need that, I feel.
We do.
So we haven't even touched on your other books. So let's have a quick think about some of them. I'd love you to tell us briefly about The Churchill Girls.
Yes. I mean, The Churchill Girls was the book before this one. And I mean, that was just a gift. Doing it was great. I was writing about Winston Churchill's daughters. So there was little Marigold, who sadly died as a toddler from septicemia. But the three other daughters, Mary Soames, who had a golden life, Diana, the eldest, who was a little more insecure and sadly died from suicide. And then Sarah, who was really the star of the show. Sarah became a Hollywood actress and was a great dancer. And each of these daughters, again, are forgotten women of history largely. And I thought they should definitely be better known about. And I think often in these sort of situations, it's that all the other characters in the family are shouting so loud, whether that was Winston Churchill or Clementine, or particularly Randolph, their brother. So people know about all of them, but they didn't really know about Winston's daughters. And I wanted to bring them to the public attention. And I mean, it was just a fascinating story to tell, particularly how they behaved in the war years and their very distinguished war careers.
Yeah, it's great, again, because we hear so much about Churchill, but how fantastic to actually hear about these fascinating women who, you know, really have, as you say, been completely forgotten by all the people shouting around them, but actually fascinating lives and stories really worth telling.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think it's important because it shed a new light on Winston. I mean, he wasn't there a lot as a father because he was sort of trying to rule the world.
Yeah.
But they absolutely adored him. Ironically, they had much more of a problem with their mother than with him.
Interesting.
And actually, in the war years, as well as doing their own war work, they did everything to support him and traveled with him when he was meeting world leaders, whether that was Roosevelt or Stalin. I mean, it gave them the most incredible insight into 20th century history. But also, Winston was ill at the time and Clementine didn't want to travel. And without them, you know, could he have done it so well? He needed someone really close to him, and they looked after him.
Absolutely. I mean, that's so important, isn't it? That they were enabling him to do all the work that he was doing. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, and we owe them a debt.
Hugely. Yeah. And it's so forgotten about. So I'm so glad that you have done this, you know, bringing women out from the past. Tell us about Mistress of the Arts.
Oh, yes. Mistress of the Arts. I mean, that was my first book and I loved that. I was inspired by this amazing cottage, Ornay, near us in Tavistock. I traveled down there and it just took me back in time to the Regency time. And I thought, how did this place happen? And I found that the 6th Duchess of Bedford created it, Georgina. And she was this remarkable woman. She created this amazing place and she was married to the Duke of Bedford, who was 20 years older than her. But when she was in her 40s, she had this passionate love affair with the Victorian artist Landseer. Mm-hmm. And he fell totally in love with her. And she was obviously quite a woman because her husband put up with this and she was able to have both men in her life and sort of go and spend half the year in Scotland with Landseer and the other half with the Duke of Woburn and Ensley.
Not a bad life.
And the lovely thing about that is, I mean, I still go to Ensley, which is now a hotel, which has been done up by Olga Polizzi and run by her. And it's the most magical place. I mean, it's my favourite place of anywhere. It's really such a special place that I, you know, would advise people to visit without doing the PR for the comfort. It's a great place.
And so tell us about, as well, Pearls Before Poppies.
Again, that was a really precious book to me. I had a wonderful time writing that. I stumbled across this story, which was about at the end of the First World War, Lady Northcliffe, who was married to the press baron, Lord Northcliffe, who ran the Daily Mail, had the idea of running this appeal for the Red Cross to ask women across Britain and the Empire to donate a pearl from their pearl necklaces to raise money for people who had been injured by the war, hurt or injured by the war, and also in memory of that life. And pearls just flooded in from across the empire and the country. And each of the pearls had an individual story, which I tell. I had to obviously select a few, but they were just such moving stories. I mean, some women had lost 3 sons, others had lost the loves of their lives. But there were also happy stories of women who'd found new fulfillment through their war work and through nursing. But each pearl represented this life lost or changed by the war. And the wonderful thing about this book was that it was taken up by the Red Cross and they launched a new appeal off the back of it and appealed again to people to donate pearls or jewellery. And they held an auction at the Savoy in the summer of 2018, marking the centenary, and it made over $250,000. And I mean, it was just such a lovely thing to be involved in.
Yeah. How incredible. And then Before Wallace, this is an interesting one. Tell us about this.
Oh, yeah. Before Wallace is fun. I mean, everyone thinks that Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, had one great love, Wallace Simpson. But my book shows that certainly wasn't true. There were at least 3 other women who he was seriously involved in before Wallace Simpson. And probably the most important was Frieda Dudley Ward, who was this married woman who he fell totally in love with and was with for 16 years. And, you know, what I show is that he was begging her to marry him, but she just wouldn't do it. You know, she knew it was called a constitutional crisis for him to marry a divorced woman. And I think, you know, it's a fascinating story of what Edward was really like. I mean, I'm afraid he came across rather pathetically, whereas Frieda actually would have made a rather good queen. And I think of her as in a different era. She could have played a very similar role to the one that Queen Camilla is now, because Frieda was very discreet, always did the right thing and, you know, sort of had very good values and would have made a good queen. But of course, in the 1930s, you couldn't have got away with that.
And do you think the fact that he did keep falling in love with women who were already married, do you think he was wanting to create a scandal? Do you think he never actually wanted to become king? Was he looking for a way out all the way through?
Yes. I mean, I think that there was a real ambivalence in him. He was very charismatic and he was very good at being Prince of Wales, but he didn't want to have any restrictions. He only wanted to be king if it could be on his terms.
Yeah.
And it just couldn't. And, I mean, he wasn't really suited to it. People who worked closely with him, like Tommy Lascelles, thought he was totally unsuited, that, again, at the heart of him, there was this sort of almost moral vacuum. And obviously, as his connections with visiting Hitler and being pro-German in the 30s show, I think we were really lucky that he did abdicate and that it was George VI and Queen Elizabeth on the throne during the Second World War, because I think it's quite likely he'd have wanted to make peace with Hitler. So I think we're lucky not to have him as king. Well, this did us a favour.
You know, I'm really, really glad he wasn't king, because whenever I looked into him, he just doesn't sound like a pleasant person at all. I think we were really well shot of him.
We were. I mean, as I say, he should have been the second. So, you know, he really just had no sense of duty. Yeah. I don't think the monarchy would have survived with him as its head.
Yeah. So when you've been writing about all these women, what's been the biggest challenge in your research journey?
It's a really enjoyable journey on the whole. But I mean, it's at the beginning when you sort of don't know if you'll be able to get the documents, if you'll be able to get the letters. Also, you know, you have to woo families and things to let you use them. I mean, I was really lucky with this book that the Christie Archive were very helpful. And I was lucky enough to meet Agatha Christie's grandson, Matthew, and interview him. So it's that sort of thing that really brings the story alive, because I love doing the research. But you never know at the start whether the families will play ball, whether they'll give you access to the documents. And without letters and without that access, you're not able to say anything new. I mean, I just love it when you're sort of doing this detective work and stumbling upon new things or things that haven't been really looked at in detail before.
It is like being a detective. I love it. And then when you make a breakthrough and you're so excited and all your friends think you're mad because it happened 150 years ago or whatever.
It is such a weird experience. It's a bit like being in love, isn't it? Because it's like these things leap out of the page of you and you go, oh, I just found this. And everyone else is like,
oh, really?
Oh, what? Well, that's a big deal. Like you say, it happened 150 years ago. And does anyone? And you're like, but this just shows. And you get so involved in it. I mean, I just love the absorption, you know. But yeah, there are ups and downs. I mean, and I think, actually, I don't know if you find, but I think the worst part, I really hate the end process when you've got to just, I mean, I'm very careful on my footnotes, but double checking everything and then clearing everything and all those sort of things. The admin isn't as fun as a detective.
No, the admin definitely isn't. And I just wondered, how does it feel when you finish a book and you're kind of saying goodbye to your characters as you're moving on to whatever you're doing next? Is that something you find difficult, or do you reach a point where you think, I'm really, this relationship is now over and I need to move on?
Yeah, I'll be interested to know what you think too. I mean, I sort of feel as though it's completed them, because otherwise they're in my head. I mean, for instance, with the Mistress of the Arts, the Duchess of Bedford, I was a journalist when I first came across the story, and it was in my head for so long. And I thought, will I ever get to write it? And it was always in my head till it was written. And then once it's written, you sort of move on. But they're like old friends. You always can come back to them. I mean, occasionally I'm talking about the books from the past. They're not at the centre of my head at the moment, you know, whatever's the next thing is. And I am sort of ready to move on. I mean, you may briefly feel a little bit bereft, but equally, as I say, I'm always interested in finding something new. And, you know, the length of the projects, you've lived with them so much and you hope you've done it thoroughly. So you are ready to move on.
Yes. We've got a comment here, how much your enthusiasm is enjoyable. And I agree. I think it's fantastic. But isn't that key, I think, to writing a good book, to writing about somebody? You have to be enthusiastic, don't you?
You have to be. And I mean, you have to feel that. I mean, you can't spend 3 or 4 years unless you are. I mean, that's the trouble. I mean, all the things I've come across, I've sort of stumbled upon them as a niche, but you have to have that feeling, that connection. And I'm afraid I'm not one of those writers who can just generate it by formula. You know, sometimes you wish you could, but there's got to be, I mean, it is like meeting people and making friends, isn't it? There's either chemistry connection or there isn't. And I'm afraid with my sort of writing, it really would show if it wasn't there.
I would find it very difficult to write about someone I didn't like. I was worried I wasn't going to like Princess Louise, for example. And then I really did. And I very much admire people who can write biographies of people like Hitler, because I would find it so tough to write a biography of someone I didn't admire. Do you feel the same, or do you?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sort of thinking about new ideas now, and I'm thinking of someone who is, but it would be quite a controversial. I mean, I'm not going to say right now because it's sort of in negotiation stages, and I'm not sure if I would like her or approve, although should one approve or not. But you know, but then again, I think probably people are mixed, so there are good parts of them and not good.
Yes.
And I think that's
like anybody. We feel like that family and friends. You know, I think with biography, you start off hero worshipping them, then they annoy you, and then you love them anyway. Is how I've always felt a little bit.
And also how you feel does change a bit, because I think I went into things like Aurelia, you know, I felt incredibly sympathetic by what I'd heard. But as I read more, I realised, no, there are definitely two sides to the story, and that I'm not blaming either Sylvia or Aurelia. It was just the chemistry between them, but it wasn't just on one side.
No.
So, I mean, it's just interesting. It's like getting to know someone, isn't it?
No,
as I say, I think it would be a challenge doing someone I didn't exactly admire, but it might be quite liberating in some ways, because you sort of sometimes can get almost too close, and I don't want to be doing a hagiography either, people, but we'll see.
Well, we've got a comment here. Fascinating to hear about these women. I loved reading the Churchill Girls. I'm inspired to read more of your book. So thank you for that. And lots of people saying this was so interesting. Thank you so much, Rachel. It's been a real pleasure to have you on. I hope that whatever you're writing next, you'll come on whenever you've finished it and talk to us about your next project. It's been brilliant to have you here on Goldster. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been lovely. And I'd love to come on again about anything. You've asked such brilliant questions.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm just going to tell everybody what's coming up next on Goldster. So I'm not around with you next week. It's Humphrey next week. On Tuesday, he's talking to Jeff Cox, the author of West Somerset in the News, and about community news and, you know, over the history of many years, looking at how people work in their community and what news can do for that community. And then I'm going to say the word community again. Humphrey and I are back together on Thursday with our community chat. This is an unrecorded, unscripted, unmuted chat where you can come on and talk about the things that we've looked at over the last year and just what you'd like on Goldster yourselves. And then on Friday, Humphrey is back with you with Juliet Campbell, author of Playing Britannia, How I Became Her Excellency. Juliet was the first of Britain's pioneering female ambassadors. It's going to be a really, really fascinating one. And just to remind you that we have Book of the Month coming up, which is Pride and Prejudice this month by Jane Austen, obviously chosen by you. And I'm thrilled to be rereading it. But the day before that, on the 25th of January, I'm interviewing another biographer, Jennifer Roberts. She's the author of several books, including The Beauty of Her Age, A Tale of Sex, Scandal and Money in Victorian England. Her other books include Fitz, The Colonial Adventures of James Edward Fitzgerald, and Entertaining the Braganzas. So she's going to be here on the 25th of January. Thank you, everybody, for coming along. And for those who've been asking for a link, it is actually in the chat, but it's Mothers of the Mind, and it's published by the History Press, should be available at all good bookshops and online as well. But obviously, if you do go online, try and get it from bookshop.org or your local bookshop. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great weekend, and I will see you on Thursday, but Humphrey will be back with you on Tuesday. And thanks again, Rachel. That was really fun.
Oh, thank you. I loved it.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.